Hello.
Hello there, Richard.
Welcome to our town, Randy.
Thank you.
It's great to have you.
Thank you.
Randy lives in New York.
So we just thought we would talk a little bit and then open it up for questions and take it from there.
What's this panel about? No, I'm kidding. Wait, it's Randy. It must be about music.
Yeah.
So okay.
Okay, we'll start there.
No. We've worked together a bunch.
We have.
Always fun.
I guess we worked most notably together on School of Rock, but the first movie that we did together was Suburbia.
Yeah.
Which I guess, Mark, that was, I think, the first time that I came to Austin. I think it was during that time.
That was a lot of fun.
And that was an interesting movie where we had Sonic Youth did the original score for us.
Yeah. That's when they actually put out soundtracks and stuff.
Yeah.
That was fun. Do you guys know Randy won a Grammy for Boardwalk Empire? I only say that to embarrass him. He didn't even go. He's that humble. He really is. But so let's not talk about me. Let's talk about all the directors you work with.
Okay.
Martin Scorsese. You're his guy.
I don't know about that.
I have a question.
Okay.
Do people turn down when you ask, like, hey, can I clear the song for Martin Scorsese? Do they ever say, like, no, like they do to me sometimes?
You know, what's interesting is that for on the Scorsese things that I do are really have been the period-based films.
Okay, yeah.
And so you're generally dealing with estates, so there's sort of less personal dynamic with it. So we generally are able to get the songs without really much of a negotiation. But it's interesting is that on Hugo Cabret that we did this year, we had a bit of a snag is that there was a famous in the 20s, there was a famous dance hall performer named Fragson, who was a sort of a sensation of the day. He was an Englishman who had made his career in France. And Fragson, at the height of his career, came home one night, and his father killed him. And the father himself then died some months later. And so, you know, the French copyright is very unique in its own way, and so we had a situation where we had a song, a recording, that we couldn't license because there was really nobody to license it from.
Yeah.
So there were no heirs. Nobody really else had the rights in it because of the circumstances. And so that was a situation where there was a song that we couldn't get because of very unique circumstances. And so...
That's so frustrating. I think... Didn't we do it once where we put... I know in one film, we just put money in escrow.
Yeah.
We said, here's the money. Whenever you guys figure out who owns it, you can have this money. But legally, it was...
Yeah. This was not... There was no way around it. And I was really trying... I was trying to figure out every which way to make that happen, but it couldn't. And we then had to spend some time, and we really were lucky enough to find some people in France, some French singers, and a French composer named Jean-Michel Bernard, and we did a pretty good recreation of it.
We did it.
It's actually that song. It's a song from that was in Grand Illusion.
Oh, okay.
And so what was interesting is that we actually then took the Fragson recorded version of it and then put the, as per Marty, this is how it goes, where he says, we'll put on the Grand Illusion chorus on it. So we actually did a bit of a mashup.
That's what's great about doing really period films. You know, the last thing I did, me and Orson Welles, was, you just get into that period.
Yeah.
In my case, it was in 1937. I love the music from that era. So it was just picking all those songs and, that's always the fun part, whatever era in the past. But so what about Todd Haynes? You work with him quite a bit.
Todd, you know, the films that I've done with Todd, Velvet Goldmine and I'm Not There, you know, Todd
that's
brings...
The Dylan thing.
Yeah, Todd brings a real scholarly passion for the work, and you know Todd, and he really is sort of like the great A student, mm-hmm. and so he does all his homework and is very, very specific.
Yeah,
and, you know, Todd is really one of the few... You know, he's a director who at a certain point, the fact that he's so song-specific, that he actually really, in pre-production, mm-hmm. times out his shots to... to the music, to the beat of the music. So it's that precise. Mm-hmm. So those have been really fun to work on, too. I guess all these things where you get actually can continue to learn as you go along, where there's, you know, by virtue of going into a period of music that you didn't really know all about it. I mean, that's what sort of keeps it fresh and
every
alive.
Every movie is like you're starting over. Different agenda, different needs for each movie.
Yeah.
I love that part of it. You know, it's like writing a new script. It's like it's a whole new,
new
blank canvas every movie. So I guess one of the guys you're also most like associated with is Wes Anderson.
Right.
You guys are doing a new movie.
Right. We have a movie coming out called Moonrise Kingdom that's going to come out in May, and it'll be the seventh movie that we've done together, and we'll make a soundtrack album, and it'll be the tenth soundtrack. We've done 10 albums on with 7 movies. So
how do you do that?
Well, we did with Life Aquatic. Okay. We did a record of the Sal George songs as a standalone, and then with Fantastic Mr. Fox, we did an Alexander Desplat sort of score. Cycle that sort of we used things that weren't in the movie and created sort of a piece of music that we put out. And I guess the other one is that we did.
And they'll put it out?
Yeah.
As a separate?
Yeah.
One.
And then
that's
we did.
To talk the record companies into. But maybe not for you guys.
Well, we've always been able to get an album. We've gotten albums out.
Yeah. The last movie I did, I didn't even want an album. I just wanted to be able to do like an iTunes, you know, release it.
Yeah. We were talking today.
We've seen that industry
evaporate.
Yeah. What happened? Where am I? What happened?
The digital revolution happened.
Yeah.
The digital revolution happened, which is to a certain degree.
They used to give you an advance.
Yeah.
You could pay for the music. It was a good deal.
Yeah. I mean, it used to be. It also, though, for you know, in certain scenarios, it was challenging because once the record companies were funding the musical element of a movie, their agenda sort of had to be addressed, and that was something I was never really particularly good at.
Yeah, that could really screw up a movie.
Yeah.
When they kind of, the music people, the music division is all over your movie. That was never a good thing.
No, I mean, you had, right? I mean, in terms of where you, with even with Dazed and Confused, right, where there was a lot of resistance or issues about putting out an album.
Yeah, I went through hell on that. When you have, it's frustrating when you have what would easily be a double album, you know, you have 30 some odd songs and they say, well, here are the 11 or 13 that are going to be on the soundtrack. It's just not representative. So they came out with another volume. I did my own. I released a third volume. I didn't release it. I gave it to friends. But back when you actually had to manufacture it, now it would be no big deal. But back then I actually made the CD and cost $1,000 or something.
Well, I was telling Rick today, or we talked about it before, is that I was asked earlier or late last year to pick 5 films for a film festival, 5 films that I had worked on, and then 5 films that had inspired me. And I chose on the side of films I worked on, I picked School of Rock, and on films that inspired me, I picked Dazed and Confused. So Rick was really the only director who was sort of represented on both sides. And, you know, one of the other films that was in the program of inspirationals was American Graffiti. And I always feel like, I always think of things as double bills. And so American Graffiti and Dazed and Confused really to me are just sort of great sort of bookmarks. Mm-hmm. And I was just wondering, was that a movie that was, did that inspire you at all, that
yeah,
movie?
I mean, I saw that when I was young and it inspired me. But, you know, the music, I think that kind of wall-to-wall music thing is started in the 60s. You know, Easy Rider does that. I think Mean Streets is a great use. I would say Graffiti, Mean Streets, Easy Rider. And before that, Kenneth Anger's Scorpio Rising, I think, was the first one to really just put kind of pop songs in the entire movie. So that was always inspiring, the way they could use it. But I think Mean Streets kind of takes it to another level because it's not like they're coming out of the radio or there's no conceit. Like it's Oldies Night or, you know, it's coming from everywhere. It's
right.
Italian opera. It's, you know, different kinds of music. You know, so I don't know. That was always a big one. But
Mason Street?
Dazed was, yeah. The movie I did right before that, Slacker, music wasn't an element at all. We had a live mm-hmm. performance at the end. There's music way in the background, but it's not a music movie at all. You know, but Dazed, I knew before I was writing it, like, music was going to be the number one character.
Right.
It was going to be the lead character in the movie would be the, you know, the music that's going on. Because mm-hmm. I felt, you know, as a teenager, that's your most expressive element of your life. You know, you can't articulate it yourself, you know, but the music is kind of speaking for you. So I just went back and got all this music I hadn't listened to in years, even as I was writing the script.
Right.
I was listening to, you know, I had about 100 songs I had picked out that I was listening to. And then when the actor showed up, I gave them all the music their character would be most into. You know, it was very different. You know, tell, you know, a girl like, oh, you like Joni Mitchell, and you like, you know, here's what you're listening to. And then some guys, it's like, okay, you're Black Sabbath, and you're, you know, Jackson Brown, and, you know, just whatever.
What's interesting is that, I mean, American Graffiti, if you remember, American Graffiti was a big double record.
Yeah.
And that was really something that, to me, that was, as far as we're talking about research, where it opened me up to this world of music that I didn't know in terms of historically. And I can only imagine that Dazed and Confused provides sort of the same roadmap to a different audience.
I pitched it like that because I had to put my own compilation together. There weren't any, 70s at that time. I was writing it in, you know, 91, 92, you know, we shot it in 92, came out in 93. But I had done all the compilation work. And I remember telling, it was at MCA or is at Universal. It's like, here's, it's going to, you know, this is a good 70s compilation.
Right.
And they were like, nah, you got to get some new bands in there somewhere.
Right, weren't there, didn't you have a thing where somebody wanted you to cover?
Yeah, we got to do some covers. And
right.
Like, have you seen the movie? What are you talking about? You know, so it... Yeah, we bumped heads from then on. And they didn't really believe in the album. They kind of gave it away.
Yeah. You did pretty well with it, though, right? It sold some copies.
Someone did well with it. Yeah. Couple double platinum.
Yeah.
Yeah. Someone. Irving Azoff did well.
Oh, yeah. Good.
They always do. But, no, I was just, you know, just lucky to get that film made, you know.
I mean, it's been interesting, too, is that, you know, you have really, in terms of your cinematic, your musical legacy, is that you also go from doing song-driven movies mm-hmm. to doing films that really are very sort of score-driven and have just sort of an original music component.
Or no music. I did a film called Tape. It was all in a room, and there's no... You don't even mm-hmm. realize it till the end. I bring up a song over the closing credits, and a song starts, a Peggy Lee song.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, oh, wow, there's been no music the whole movie. So it just depends on what the movie needs. You know, there's some purist in me, and it's the European art film guy. You know, like, some guys would say... Like Robert Bresson, my favorite French director, he's like, music, you don't need it in movies unless it's live. You know, you shouldn't. Tarkovsky, a lot of people thought the purest thing, the movie should just be musical itself. That mm-hmm. one of the worst things that's happened in movies has been the
overdriving
production
music.
Of score. You know, so a movie shouldn't have to operate on that level. So I always kind of aim for that. But yes, you know, when I approach a film, it's like, I knew on Scanner Darkly, I'm working with Graham Reynolds, a great local composer who worked on that for a long time. But I always knew it would be score. There wasn't really any.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I did end up with quite a few songs. You know, we had Tom York gave us a song for mm-hmm. closing and, you know, all this cool stuff. But mainly it was score driven, you know. But that's a fun collaboration. You know, I'm not a musician, but I love music so much. It's been such a big part of my life, but learning to talk to musicians and people doing the score. Remember on Suburbia working with Sonic Youth? How
yeah.
At one point you called me up and just, what did you say? They would go in their studio. This is how long ago this was, the late 90s. They were always having to send out tapes, so they couldn't. It was always 3 days late.
Right.
So you're like, they're retarded. You
know? Right, you'd have
to always get with the drummer. To get the drummer is usually the guy who can actually effect.
Yeah, I mean, that's been an interesting, that's been a really interesting part
it's
of
so different now.
Of the process is where I used to travel around with like, I think I probably came down here, I probably had like a suitcase filled with CDs and used to get videotape that would come to FedEx and download it and upload it.
Scripts. It's a little different. Yeah, that's great.
You know, in terms of this, you know, it's interesting where you talk about musical nostalgia and how do you, the challenge of making the music of an older era vibrant for a contemporary audience. Because a lot of times, say, for instance, when we did I'm Not There, say there's the moment where Dylan goes electric, which is this revolutionary moment in music, and you play it for a contemporary, for kids, and they're like, well, yeah, that's just like, that's rock and roll.
Yeah, the context.
And
of that
so how do you, how do you bring something to it that gives you the impression of its originality in that moment, you know, that somehow trumps authenticity to a certain degree. And so I think a lot about how, you know, where your perspective is on the music versus where, you know, from where you've been or in your timeline of life. I was wondering, did you see the movie Drive? Did you see that film?
No, I haven't seen it yet. I have a screener.
Is that have people here seen the movie Drive? And people fans of the movie Drive?
Yeah.
It's interesting.
Thanks for making me feel completely out of it. Randy.
Yeah.
I get to it. I had a busy year. I got kids.
Well, I'd be interested to hear what you have to say about about it. Because
I'll call you as soon as I see it.
Okay.
I'll go home and watch it after this. But score or no score? Source music or no source? You know, these are the questions. Oh, I brought something for you, Randy.
Oh, yeah?
Does this look familiar? John Pearson gave it to me. This is a cassette for those of you who are young. This is like a...
That's funny.
We used to put those in like the deck and listen to
what this is, actually, the first movie that I ever worked on, it was a movie that I wrote. It was called A Matter of Degrees, and it was about a college radio station, and we made it. It came out in 1990. And so as we were trying to get this movie made, we were recording a lot of music. And so sort of every time I did a new song, we were trying to get people to... We were having to finance the movie at every step of the way.
Total indie.
And thing. So...
made in and around Brown University.
Yeah.
Your alma mater, right?
Yeah. And so this is a... John Pearson, the great John Pearson, was a producer's rep who was a person who could be pivotal in helping you get money to finish a movie. And so this is a cassette I made of five songs that we had recorded originally for the film. Stove by the Lemonheads... Homer by Miracle Legion, A Matter of Degrees by Throwing Muses, Never Decide by Yola Tango, and Max and Wells by Firehose.
Firehose, yeah.
So, wow. I haven't seen one of those in a long time.
And that movie has John Kennedy Jr. playing
guitar. Yeah.
I saw it in Berlin that year.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I was there.
I remember that. That's JFK Jr.
Yeah. John Doe from X was in the movie.
Yeah, he's an actor in it.
Yeah.
In the music.
Yeah. We look pretty good, though, right, for our age?
I have stomach problems.
Yeah. Well, should we see if they have any questions for us, or?
Finally, we'll open it up to. Yeah. Sorry, they told us to talk for a while first. So.
Is there any song that you felt would have really made any of your movies, but you just couldn't get the rights to it? And inversely, is there any song?
God, the song that got away? You mean, that's a tough one. There's been a few. On Dazed, I had a couple. I had at the end of the beer bus, the party at the Moon Tower, when the camera cranes up, I had Dream On by Aerosmith for there for a long time. And I'd already gotten Sweet Emotion for the opening credits. And I thought we were in, but there was a different management company, different label, and we just couldn't get Dream On. But I ended up okay using Tuesday's Gone with, I remember, but we were mixing the movie when we got the definitive word, we can't use it, so I was kind of scrambling, but I had all these other songs to pick from. But I remember it was the music mixer, you know, you're working with three mixers, and we were talking about it, and he said, you know, Tuesday's Gone's got that same kind of thing. I'm like, oh yeah, I went back and listened to that, worked great. So I remember that guy, you know, just, you never know where a good idea is going to come from. but there were other songs that...
Well, the Led Zeppelin is kind of a legendary scenario.
Yeah, at the very end, the closing credits, I had Rock and Roll by Led Zeppelin, but at that point, they just weren't... Nobody had ever had a Zeppelin song in a movie. It just didn't happen, but I took a good run, almost got it, but not quite. But I was really happy with Slow Ride. You know, that was replaceable. But you know, you get your heart. I was very entitled, snot-nosed young guy thinking the world owed me everything. Now I'm just, you know.
So how did you handle the news of not getting Led Zeppelin?
Not well. Not so.
Well, that leads us into, there's a story.
Embarrassingly not.
Is that we had Led Zeppelin in School of Rock.
But it worked good, like 10 years later.
Yeah, we had Led Zeppelin in School of Rock.
Yes.
And we sort of positioned ourselves. You know, I sort of laid some of the tried to satisfy some of the political elements of it.
Yeah, it's always a little tightrope.
And then we had Jack Black do an incredible...
Yeah, in between takes, I had him do a plea to the guys. And that ended up on the DVD.
Yeah, that was on the DVD.
But we filmed it with a Steadicam. We had some extra. We got to do this real quick one in between shots.
So, and we paid a lot of money too. And then
the bottom line, you pay a lot.
And Rick had not really, as he said, hadn't taken his rejection by Led Zeppelin very well in the day, and I guess made some comments about some of the people in the management company of Led Zeppelin. And so when I finally had to then deal with the managers at the end for School of Rock, I got the response was like, tell Rick that the asshole from the management company let him have the song.
Ooh.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Tell him thank you, but he's still an asshole. Okay. No, that was really wonderful for me to have that come by 10 years, you know, the way life kind of cycles back around.
Right.
That was really wonderful to have that song.
Yeah.
To have them in there was special, you know.
Randall, I was wondering what the relationship is between you and the person doing the score or the original. You know, like Mark Mothersbaugh was in here just a couple hours ago. So
oh,
like
really?
Wes.
You know, it varies from situation to situation, depending on the relationship between the director and the composer. Oftentimes, for instance, like Sam Mendes, who I work with pretty regularly, he works with Thomas Newman, and their work together predates my involvement with Sam. And they sort of go and do their thing, and I do my thing, and there really isn't much interaction. And then in other situations, like for instance, with, say, Hugo Cabret, Howard Shore and I have worked together a little bit, but he really likes to listen to what's happening with the source music and lets it inform his score a little bit. So I had gone out and recorded all this French musette, and I think that really kind of helped him figure out how to orchestrate the rest of the score. So it varies from project to project. Sometimes, you know, I like to work with younger filmmakers, and so sometimes their inexperience in terms of having that kind of dialogue or talking about music sometimes is... You have to sort of kind of establish a common vocabulary and just sort of help to facilitate communication. So that's really kind of the role that I play, just to make sure that we're all sort of using the same words to talk about the music.
Mm-hmm. And different films have different needs. On School of Rock, I mean, we were all over the map. It was like making a musical. We were creating a lot of music for the movie, for live performance.
Right.
We were clearing a bunch of songs. That, you know, in the movie, and a little bit of score too.
Right, so I think we have about like 5.5 minutes of
all the thing.
Minutes of score in the movie.
But it's important when you need it.
Yeah.
You know, so in that case, but you were great about hooking us up. Like we formed a band. We had all these little kids, but I was like, we're going to be a band. You know,
yeah.
All the kids could play, and so
we have George Trakoulias is in the
is George
is in
here?
The audience. Yeah, George,
the man.
Raise your hand.
Where's George? Say, oh, hey, man.
And George worked with us. George produced the School of Rock, the band.
Yeah, yeah.
And we worked those kids really hard.
Sure did. And that was an interesting clash between, you know, film industry and music industry on top of each other, you know, overlapping. Like, film is all about rehearsal, planning, scheduling. And, you know, we were well into production, and that final number had to work. You hooked us up with, you know, it was like, who to do the music? And you hooked us up with Mooney Suzuki.
Mooney Suzuki.
But rehearsing with them and getting it, you know, the clock's ticking, weeks are going by, we're rehearsing on weekends. It was just, I remember being kind of frustrated, like, you know, the music industry, it's like, yeah, whenever, we'll get there. And we're like, no, we're making a movie. It's like, so, but we got there.
Yeah. I mean, that song just had to be just right.
Yeah, it was the right tone. But that was a lot of fun, though. I'd never really done that to that degree of, like, originating pop-type songs.
Right.
You know, it was...
Yeah, I don't know that there's anything really quite exactly like it.
It was fun, that song at the beginning, and all the, you know, the alternate band.
Right.
Yeah. You
know. Heal Me, I'm Heartsick.
Yeah, that was so great. Those are really my favorite songs on that soundtrack, because they're so... It was the fine line between... I said, I wanted that teenage girls love it, and everyone over a certain age laughs at it. You know, can we hit that, you know? But Craig was... He was awesome.
Craig Wedren, right.
Yeah. On DVD? I hope so. That's my only film that's not really available for some reason. It was companies moved around. It was at Warner Brothers. I thought Criterion wanted to do it, so it might come out someday, but someday we're kind of working on it. But I'm really proud of that soundtrack, too.
Yeah. Is Susan here from Criterion?
I saw her the other night.
Yeah.
We need to bust
maybe she's working on. Maybe she's working on it.
She's working on it as we speak. As we speak. But that's, the Sonic Youth score on that I thought was really wonderful. This is a film none of you have seen, so we're not going to talk about it much. But, Sonic Youth was good. Beck gave us the song. It was, some good stuff.
Flaming Lips.
Yeah. It was fun. Yeah, but someday. Soundtrack's available, though.
Yeah, thanks a lot for coming. It's an honor to have you here. I'm just really excited to be here and, see you in the flesh. But I just graduated film school. I just made another short film, and I wanted to get some reggae songs in there, Desmond Dekker songs. It's only been like a couple of weeks since I haven't had a response from the publishing company and stuff. But I'm a little bit worried and stuff. So I was just wondering if you had any tips for people who are just starting out filmmakers to make sure that we can actually get the licensing for songs.
It's a tough one when you don't. Assuming you don't have a lot of money and you're just, can I use your song in my movie or short? I mean, there's that thing, festival rights, do they still do that? But that doesn't get you much.
Yeah, I'm not a big advocate of festival rights.
It sends a mixed message, yeah.
I would say you just have to be relentless. Don't give up. Just keep at it. Just keep pressing. Maybe it's Susan.
Plea. Send a personal plea. I think they get things.
Do we get the rights?
A personal plea. Passion goes a long way. If you really explain why this will only work with this song, you've had this song in your head for years, and people respond to that, artist to artist. I've found, they go, it's a good... Most musicians want to see their music used in an interesting way, or, it amuses them in some way.
Yeah.
If it's no money.
Publishing companies respond to passion.
I think at a certain point,
They do actually. I met with a publisher once. I was getting these ZZ Top songs, and I met the publisher and told him how important it was, and he responded.
Keep at it. Keep at it.
Yeah, you're hoping they just take it to the next step. Yeah. That's all you can do.
Back there.
How was the composition delivered to the arranger? Is that a sample creation or is it a finale thing or
what's that?
How was the finished composition, the score, delivered to the arrangers? Or do you do that all yourself? Is there a process for delivering a completed piece of work?
From the composer to the arranger to the... That's a pretty inside...
Yeah, composers generally work with arrangers.
Yeah, that's an interesting relationship. I got to know working with composers about that special relationship. I hadn't really thought about much. But sure they have their own methods. I don't think it's a big deal. However, whatever works between them.
MIDI files.
Yeah. I don't know. There's a question.
You're going to have to project your voice.
You mentioned substituting a song when you were frustrated. You found a song with a similar mood or a similar oeuvre. Is there anybody that can help with that, or the consultants or databases that would help you match your mood and your atmosphere to a song and to write to the one you want?
I don't know. Is there an app for that yet? You know, that could just, I mean, there probably is something you could use to take you to, what's it called?
Allmusicguide.com.
Sound alike, feel alike. Yeah, Pandora on its own kind of takes you there. So,
Back in the olden days, there used to be these guys called music supervisors,
right.
And they used to
They're
do
dinosaurs.
That. They used to do that kind of work. They used to do that kind of work.
Kind of reptilian little things out of their scales, creatures. Best if you have one in your own head, like, here's a song I would like to get, but if that doesn't work, here's what I have, and here's another and another and another. That would be okay, too. So, whether you can clear it, that's another thing.
Over here.
So throughout both of you, I'm over here. Throughout, hey.
Oh, okay.
Sorry.
Throughout both of your careers, you've done so many films that had a really coherent and well-suited vision of the way the music suited the film itself, which I think is, you know, what every film should be, but there's no formula for it. And every time I watch something like Clockwork Orange, it's like it feels like there's no limit to the amount of ways music can be used. And you mentioned something earlier about, you know, intentionality, like what you want to do to the audience. And then at the same time, music is so personal, you know. And I'm very curious, like, as you develop a vision, both as a director and a supervisor, is there any general principle that you try always to not, like, break or to try to fulfill that helps you work that out? I'm curious to hear from each of you.
My answer to that is there's no one principle. It changes from movie to movie. I think a director's job is to kind of set the tone with everything. So you might head into the musical thinking. Or I like that process of just feeling your way through. What should the music be? And usually that's at the script phase for me. It's really early. You don't do that in post. It's too late. You know, you really has to be part and parcel of the whole process. But you might know already, like, okay, we'll need a score here. But, you know, no strings, you know, some rules might start floating into how you're feeling your way through it or what instruments. Yeah, that's just the kind of the fun art of it, I guess. But I don't think there's any one, you know, you mentioned Clockwork Orange. I think Kubrick was, you know, his scores are, you know, usually classically based, but he would jump around. But his attitude was, why get a current composer when you can use the best music ever written? It's available, whether it's, you know, I love his soundtracks because he's grabbing from everywhere, mm-hmm. but usually historically classical. But his use of Penderecki in Shining was effective, you know.
Well, you know, I would say to your point about how do you arbitrate in terms of if something is so personal. I mean, that's the value and the good fortune that I've had in terms of when you work with a great director, is that that's the sensibility that is ultimately going to establish certain creative boundaries, challenges, formulas for that particular movie, you know, and hopefully, you know, by virtue of having a relationship that you, your own instincts or feelings can be part of the dialogue. I would say as far as breaking rules or setting rules, I found as time has gone on is that the passage of time erases certain rules, you know, where if you say, you know, I would say, you know what, you don't wear a plaid shirt with checked pants. And then somehow, 10 years later, a young director said, hey, plaid shirt, check pants. And he's going to go, well, that never works. And then all of a sudden, you're looking at it, you go, kind of works.
It does work.
And so I think in order to keep yourself sort of vital artistically, I think you have to be open to the fact that it's fluid. Art is fluid. And so somehow mm-hmm. things that somehow worked in or didn't work in 2000, somehow in 2013, they somehow make sense. So, and that's exciting. And that's what I think is an impetus to sort of continue to try to do interesting work rather than just sort of simply professional work.
Mm-hmm. My most recent film, Bernie, which plays tomorrow night, actually, at the Paramount. It's set in East Texas. It's a small town, and a lot of it is around, like, church and funerals. The lead character is big in the church, and I started getting this idea of hymns early on, just, again, at that pretty early phase. And I thought, well, hymns, songs I remember, you know, from churches I went to as a kid. And so we kind of went in that direction. And then I discovered how many composers actually use hymns in their compositions. You know, there's, you know, I didn't really thought of that. But once I thought of hymn-specific melodies, songs, and, you know, so we went there. Jack Black sings a lot of these kind of religious songs in the movie. And it's really funny. But that just took me into a genre I hadn't really thought about. But that permeates the movie completely. So, but I really saw composers who, there's a, you know, in the True Grit remake that the Coen brothers, a lot of those are hymns. You might not know it, but they're throughout that movie. That opened my eyes to that phenomenon. But it's a good place to go. Film schools? Did you go to film school? Brown is one big, yeah.
I was an English major.
Yeah, I was too, kind of. I like the UT Film School because I've lived around it for all these years. A lot of friends teach there. I took a few film classes, but there's no one opinion. Just like we were talking about this, there's no one film school experience. There's no one anything, you know, so... If you're wondering whether to go or not, that's such a personal...
I think that really, like, people come to me and all say, well, how do you become a music supervisor? I said, well, find your friends and make a movie.
Yeah.
And I think that it seems to me like film school is a way, at least there's a way that you can sort of step into some kind of community. Yeah. And it takes, you know, it's very challenging to sort of do things completely on your own. So I think mm-hmm. the fact that you can brush up against and find people who are creative and are passionate about making movies, I think that's probably a good thing.
I didn't really need film school for that because I was starting a film society here. I had my film friends already, so that sort of worked out for me. But I think if you're new in a community, the best thing about film school, I think, would be to some hopefully long-term friends you meet who have a similar aesthetic and similar ambitions, and it's just fun to... I've seen people go to film school together. Now they're in their 30s and they're still making films together just here locally. And I was very touched because I saw them as students and graduate students making their films. And I see them as professionals now, you know, winning awards for their documentaries and their films. And it's cool to see that they're still kind of this loose coalition of friends. You know, you see, so your goal would be to have your own group of that. But, you know, you got to be a good film friend too, you know, so.
Richard, I really like your example of being dazed, giving the actors music to go wide out with their character. And I was wondering from a creative writing standpoint, do you use music to inspire you to help you write, or if you're not going to use music, do you specifically avoid music?
No, I always have music on, but, you know, yeah, when you're getting specific, I like having the music that's inspiring what you're writing, sure. I mean, I think, I don't know, I can't say all writers do that, but I certainly do. Even when I'm not, a lot of it's completely unrelated to maybe what I'm writing, but it's something I know is going to inspire me at that morning or afternoon or whatever. So, I don't know. But if I'm writing a script, that, yeah, the sooner the music can be flowing around, the better. And I try to give it to the crew and cast. In Bernie, we were lucky that the lead character, there was a lot of recordings of him singing these church songs and stuff, so that started to permeate the production, which is really special. You know, we had the guy the movie's based on, his own recordings. He's in prison now, but we have all the recordings. His recordings live on.
I actually have a question for each of you. Randall, I run a conference for film festivals, which actually happens in Austin.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious about your comment about you don't like film festival clearances. And I also did want to ask you, too, about Julie Delphi playing the guitar at the end of Before Sun
Set. Yeah.
Set, mm-hmm. Which is, those are two of my all-time favorite movies. And I'd love to have you ended that movie because it was not an obvious, it wasn't the obvious sort of they tumble into bed. I'd love to hear about that, but I am also curious about your.
Well, I just feel with film festival rights is you end up paying twice. So, you know, I sort of think that I have an off-the-record sort of point of view about that otherwise, but I just sort of think that you might as well just go for the full-on clearance. And
sometimes you can't get it. Like, for instance, would only get a festival clearance.
Mm-hmm. Well,
at festivals or?
It can only be seen at festivals.
Well, almost, this is the off the record part, maybe, okay. From me and Randy. You know, I've done it a lot, especially early on. I made a whole movie and just put in music, and I was like, they're not going to sue me. I'm nobody. You know, it's like, really, they're going to spend corporate dollars for my film? Nobody's going to see. You know, and then if you're lucky, you know, 15 years later, someone was trying to clear it and went and made some deals and cleared some of the songs I used completely illegally years earlier. And no grudge taken, I think, you know. But, you know.
Well,
if you've got nothing to lose.
I mean, sometimes in film festivals too, you're showing movies that you're gonna aren't necessarily finished films anyway. Then you should get the right. Then you need to get the rights.
But if you do have commercial ambitions, or it's a commercial film, yeah, don't mess around. If it's some, I don't know. It's your own call. But you didn't hear it here. But.
And what about Julie Delpy?
You know, Julie Delpy, who's amazing. She had just put out an album before we were working on that movie, and I liked it so much. Julie's amazing. Like. I visited her. I was in L.A. I visited her one time. She was taking guitar lessons. I visited her a year later, and she was putting out an album. You know, she went from... She had all these songs, and they're really wonderful. So there's this album out that she did. And she performed at South By around, you know, 7 years ago, her band. And I just really liked some of that music. But she was playing me some, and I was thinking, oh, that's going to be the... And, like, if we could get up to the apartment and she would play a song, that would be cool. You know, sort of bookend. He had his creativity, you know, his book at the beginning, her song at the end. It's something kind of felt right. It's not the end of the movie, but it's in the last scene. So.
Did you ever find that many...
Hi, thanks for coming. Have you met... many directors who... You know, you always hear that, you know, directors had this strong vision for a film... and sometimes, have you found that some of that vision didn't incorporate music? Like, they just weren't thinking musically? And that you had to, had to help them along or something? Or do all directors tend to?
I think sometimes music is, sometimes a director comes in with a really fully formed notion of how the music is going to work. And even then, sometimes they get into the process of making the movie, and they realize that the music is not really going to accommodate the reality of what they've been doing, or that they've been opened up to a sort of a new element of the story that somehow requires something different. It's worked even on different movies with different directors. Is that sometimes it's clearer, and sometimes it needs to evolve as the process continues. You know, obviously, if there's on-camera music, there has to be more commitment and responsibility right away. But otherwise, it is one of the areas that...
You can float.
You have that kind of flexibility and dexterity.
Yeah, I don't want to sound like I'm the guy who has it all worked out in advance. Like the way you described Todd with the things. I have a lot of music, but I don't always have, like, what scene it's going to go under. You know, a movie like Dazed, I was still in the editing, waking up. With songs in my head, trying them in different places. I knew the music, but I didn't know absolutely every, not that detailed. So you don't have to feel bad if you don't have it all. I just think have a general you know, thrust to what you're trying to do. And that, you know, like working with you, once we're on that page together, then, you know, everyone can throw in ideas and have you heard this? And that's the fun, the fun collaborative part of all this.
You know, sometimes I think that one of the challenges of being a director, from my vantage point, is that you're constantly being asked questions, like in the course of a day, just it's endless amount of questions. And I think that for the true directors, they always have an answer, right? And yet, sometimes the answer is, I don't know.
Yeah.
And we've talked about this, too, I think a little bit, too, is that sometimes where you're forced to, and I don't know how necessarily this is just with music, is that sometimes you give an answer that as things progress, you realize maybe wasn't the exactly correct answer, and then how do you then make the adjustment to accommodate a decision that was made earlier in the process? And sometimes music is the thing that can actually help make that, help you make that kind of adjustment.
Hi, I was just curious, and it's kind of funny that you brought up Drive, because the composer, Cliff Martinez, was just in the other room before this, and he mentioned that the Drive soundtrack sold, I think the number he threw out was 100,000 copies or something like that, and he said that was relatively unheard of, that soundtracks don't usually sell
that
well.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
It's a lot these days.
I was curious, with the way that the music industry is going right now, do you think that kind of shows soundtracks are getting more popularity, more attention now versus, you know, sales kind of dropping off and people sharing music, like other music?
You know, I think that still, I mean, if you can create something that has a novelty or is phenomenal or is a wholesome collection, I think there is a certain audience for it. But I'm afraid to say that I think that...
I see a movie and I go, I want the music from that movie. You know, I don't know why.
Yeah, I think people do. I think I steal it
like everybody else.
Yeah, or people want... Or actually, I mean, I think I saw that Jeff Barrow, the guy who's in Portishead, is actually... He's now releasing, I think, Drive on... He's going to do a vinyl set of it. So I think that they're... You know, I think as a rule, I mean, as a general rule, sales of physical product is just sort of... continues to diminish, but I mean, I think there's always an audience for something.
I just thought of something that helped crater the soundtrack industry while we talk about. Remember when they started coming out like songs inspired by the movie Speed?
Yeah.
You know, it's like, oh. So when you ever saw Inspired By, it's like, okay, there's a record company cramming all their new acts or, you know, whatever, and they're using the movie, and just, I think people quit trusting it. It's like you got disappointed. You went, you liked the movie, you go buy the soundtrack, spend your $14, and there's one, the song you really want's not there, and then there's all this shit that you didn't, it wasn't even in the movie. I was always pissed on School of Rock because they said it was some technical, because Jack and the young keyboard player played Touch Me by the Doors.
Right.
And so we had the actual song by the Doors on the soundtrack.
Right.
That seems fair enough to me.
Right.
You know, it's like, yeah, it's not, but it's.
Right. Dun. Yeah, pretty
much. And lame. So they had to, right there on the. Songs from and inspired by, like, don't put that.
I'm sorry about that.
I blame you, Randy, to this day.
I'm sorry about that.
I just, you see that and you just go, stay away. Some legal thing, I think they.
I mean, back in the day, I mean, we did sell. I think we sold over 400,000 copies of The School of Rock. Yeah,
that's a lot because music in that movie was expensive.
Yeah,
AC/DC alone made of. I mean, this is like I thought. Days, you know, when I paid like $100,000 for like the opening credit song, I thought that was like, my God, how could you? That's such a large percentage of my budget. And AC/DC, like, there's a scene where Jack just says, and those for those of you about to rock, I said, you know, just a quote, like $250,000.
Yeah.
You know, AC/DC made more off School of Rock than their 1980 tour. You know, and by their manager or someone saying yes four times to little crap we were doing. It was unbelievable. But those days are kind of over, too. Are they? Does it still cost that much? I haven't been in that position lately.
No, I mean, certain things, but, you know, look, I to tell you the truth, when we, if the studio was going to pay, I was happy to spend the money.
Yeah. Well, you kind of have to, because you can go back on the indie film, and you've helped me numerous times. It's just that call, you know, when Randy Poster's on the other line and he's asking kind of for, oh, here's this little film I'm doing, but, you know, I've got Boardwalk Empire. I've got these big films down the way. You know, have to imply there's a payday somewhere in your universe.
Yeah, we're just hoping that George and I just need to get Todd Phillips to make Hangover 3 in the next 12 months.
Yeah, which he will. And then, yeah, that'd be good. But, yeah, you got me... For Bernie, we got 76 trombones,
right.
That's a tough one to...
Right, from Paul McCartney's company.
Yeah, he owns everything.
So
yeah,
we got them to help out.
From Music Man, which is, you know, it's kind of out there usage of it. So, and didn't have any money, so...
I think we have time for one more question. A
couple more questions? Is that... They better be good. Yeah. Next.
Do you guys each have a favorite sync moment? And I'm sure you have so many that it's tough to call one to mind. So if not, maybe a story of one that came together that, you know, you really love.
Oh, my God. Of all in film history or...
Oh, no, of your own work.
Personal.
Of your own
work. Wow. Do you, Randy?
Well, you know, I'm gonna name one in particular that is... when we were working on School of Rock, I was completely mesmerized by the Black Keys... And so Set You Free is in the scene that plays just before Jack does his Stevie Nicks impersonation.
Yeah.
And that was one that I wanted that song in the movie.
Like,
I wanted the section of that song, the section
of that
song that I wanted in the movie.
From those guys.
And I wanted it to be played as loud as I wanted it to be played in the movie. And that was the day that I was just on the stage and I just was not going to let it be otherwise than...
And I'm glad
we had to place it. So that's one that I would say I'm particularly proud of.
God, I'm kind of overwhelmed with your question. I got so many that I don't know. I mean, what? I remember in Dazed, it was kind of these things that kind of come out of a dream state. I was getting my a root canal and I was on nitrous. And I was thinking of the script I was working on, and I had heard some on the radio or somewhere, like the beginning of Sweet Emotion. That's what got me the beginning of the movie, that kind of percolating. That was just totally a legal drug trippy kind of thing. So that was... So it's kind of fun when those things sort of come to you, or in a dream you wake up with a song you're thinking about. That movie has so many because there's so many examples, but I don't know. That was one that I'll always be, I don't know if proud is the word, but happy with.
One last question. Go ahead.
Seems to have their stuff together, but for somebody like me who it's kind of a personal thing to accomplish and shoot something, I'm in my mid-30s, I'm not going to film school or anything, but what kind of advice do you have for someone like me who I'm just learning all of this, and I've started writing, I've kind of been reading on how to write a screenplay, which is kind of weird in itself, but how to learn the logistics to go about to get from point A to B, like, do you have advice to...
Whole thing about filmmaking?
You know,
the whole thing? Well, script to
from
distribution?
You know, I know I need to take it step by step and learn as I go.
You're at the right place, you know. Keep asking that. But you might want to break the question down into parts.
But, I mean, where do I go to learn how, like, let's say, do I go from this to storyboards, or how do I go from storyboards?
You can teach yourself everything. Just start doing it, and you'll learn all those processes. I think, you know, no one's going to teach you. And then maybe that relates to this film school question. You know, and I think there's something that if you can't self-motivatingly learn all of it, you probably don't have the right personality type to actually do it to the degree you're going to have to, the motivation and the passion you're going to have to exude toward it. You have to be so self-generating if you can't teach yourself it. Whether it's, you know, music editing, all the steps, then it's going to be hard anyway. So that's a good little litmus test to see if you're even you're in the right world to begin with. If you like it enough to do that and nothing else. You know, people tell me, oh, I want to make films. I said, yeah, everybody wants to. I mean, like, what are you doing right now? You know, it's just if you'd rather be on a ski vacation, you're not a filmmaker. You know, instead of editing, you're such a life. It's such a life choice decision that I would tread in very lightly. You know, and with warning signals. You know,
that's a great way to end.
With that pessimistic.
No, I think it's optimistic. Optimistic. It's really the flip side of that. It's just like, you can do it.
Absolutely can do it, but only you will know if you're doing it, you know, for the long time. So anyway, well, thanks for being
everybody.
With us today. So.
Is this for me to...